Hi everyone, I'm Heidi Rogers, and this is Tell the Others. I wanted to create a place for meaningful conversation, life lessons, and parenting hacks. Sometimes I chat to interesting people, sometimes I answer questions about parenting or life stuff, and sometimes I just rant. These episodes are filled with stories and insights that made me say, ugh, I just have to tell the others. So let's dive in to hear what we can learn today. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tell the Others. I'm Heidi Rogers, and I am joined today by one of my favorite Instagrammers that I've been following for a few years. His handle is Justin LMFT. Is that correct, Justin?
Yeah, that's it.
Yep. And Justin is a fellow polyvagal theory nerd with me. And I first found his work on Instagram because I was excited to see someone else nerding out about polyvagal theory. And then also someone who is able to explain it in a really simple way. And that is cool because polyvagal is complex. And so whenever I meet someone that can explain it in a simple way, it's like exciting. So Justin, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I am super happy to talk at pretty much any time about polyvagal theory. I don't ever really get tired of it. I think there may be people who are tired of hearing it from me. So I relish the opportunities to kind of go into anything polyvagal theory related.
Yeah.
So awesome. I appreciate you having me on. Yeah. My name's Justin Sinceri, licensed marriage and family therapist. That's the LMFT in California. That's our schooling, our credentialing is LMFT. And I currently am working at a few high schools. I work at a local school district and they have me stationed at a few high schools. I work with teens, but through my career, I've worked mostly with kids and teens and parents, parenting groups. And I've recently, within the past couple of years, started a after hours therapy practice for adults, just doing like online virtual kind of stuff, which I'm loving. I think polyvagal theory was, I feel like it's still relatively new to me, even though I've been like way into this for probably a few years now. Podcast is a couple of years old, but a few years into it, like I still feel like it's new and there's still new things to learn and like go into, you know, like I still haven't. I don't know if you ever feel like you mastered it, but I want to get to that point where I've can go beyond the basics and I can get, can really describe the more deeper biological stuff, the Porges level stuff, which is probably not possible, but I want to strive for that, you know?
Totally. I know. Whenever I explain it in presentations, it's always like just one or two slides. And I always say, this is like sacrilege. This is just horrifying to me. And Porges would probably be so insulted that dwindling his life's work down to two slides. But yeah, when you have an hour webinar or an hour presentation, it's like, I gotta pick and choose. But If you can just sort of start, well, I guess one, why are you curious about it? Or why did you get into it? Like, I mean, you have a whole podcast that's literally devoted to this. Why did it click with you or resonate? Or what made you go, whoa, what? Like people aren't choosing to, you know, quote unquote misbehave, or kids aren't actually naughty, you know, like what made you get into it? Why'd you fall in love with it?
It was this, like you said, I mean, like it's this like judgment-free explanation of what's happening internally and how that affects our thoughts and our behaviors and our relationships and why people have a difficult time breaking out of these cycles that they kind of get stuck in. I had found it when I was working with a particular student who was deeply entrenched in a very shut down, very dissociative state. And I kind of felt like I was out of my league. Felt like I was a very competent therapist. I felt very confident in myself, you know, but I had been working with this person for maybe a year and I was like, I'm not helping. And I don't know what to do either. And I had done numerous different angles and techniques. And I already knew how important relationship was and building a relationship. And even that was a challenge. And so I work in a school district again. And there was one summer, usually kids don't want to meet during the summer. They want nothing to do with school. And I was like, you know, I'm just going to start. I know trauma has something to do with this. I knew a little bit of trauma about this student, just a teeny tiny piece. But I assumed there was a lot there I just didn't know about. And so that summer, I'm like, I'm just going to start over and assume I know nothing about trauma. I had heard it somehow lived in the body. No one really ever explained that. But I kept hearing that. It lives in the body, like something to do with the brain. Like, okay, cool. But there was never any, and here's how it works. And so that summer I'm like, I just typed in trauma in YouTube as any good scholar would. And I just blank slate, and I started to click here and there. And I found Peter Levine, who created somatic experiencing. And my first impression of it was like, this is nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, he had these videos of like, it looked like just curing someone by having them move their jaw slowly. You know what I mean? Or just be a little bit more mindful about whatever. And I'm like, stop. Yeah. But something happened. Like, it planted a seed in me. And I was like, no, there's something to this. And I reminded myself, you know nothing. Like, take it seriously. Don't brush it off. And that led me to Dr. Porges doing one of his lectures. Very dry, very academic. And I picked up enough to be like, oh, like this matches, this fits in with that Peter Levine guy. And there's a deeper biological explanation happening here. And I could pick up enough of like, this is starting to click. You know what I mean? And so I would take notes furiously. I went to his book, took notes, just tried to like conceptualize this. Can I take this information and then reword it to myself so it makes sense? And then my goal was to have it make sense to me, but then also to teach teachers about it. But also, you know, how can I teach clients about this? Like, how can I reword this in ways that anybody can make sense of? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's kind of, I guess, a long story of kind of how I came across this. Mm-hmm. And what drove me is that like, it was a big part of the explanation of how trauma works, what trauma mm-hmm. actually is, mm-hmm. how it lives in the body, how we get stuck in these mm-hmm. states. Mm-hmm. And it's also a big piece of the puzzle when it comes to attachment and mm-hmm. relationship building. I mean, it's just such a big piece of all of the stuff we learn about in therapy school, but really don't get that next level of education. At least I didn't. And from what I hear from others, that they don't get that next level.
Yeah. And I didn't get it either. And all of my colleagues here in the States, in the UK, whatever we are, psychiatrists, psychologists, psychologists, psychotherapists, it doesn't matter like what we are, or LMFT, social workers, mm-hmm. mental health social workers, it doesn't matter. All of us say, I've had this conversation so many times with clinicians, why didn't we learn about this right. in school? Why is like, I don't even remember learning about the vagus nerve. Like, I don't. And then I'm like, what are we teaching the next generation? And that's why I also feel really passionate about teaching this stuff to teachers and parents, obviously, but like to teachers, because I'm like, they're with kids all day, every day. What a difficult situation to be in a classroom with a kid who doesn't know how to regulate, and they are stuck with not knowing how to help this kid. And again, it's like, why are teachers taught this stuff? You know? So yeah. Totally agree with you. And Peter Levine was also my gateway drug to all really? Of this stuff as well. Yeah. Waking the Tiger was the first book that I read when I started doing trauma work. And that just blew my mind. And same, I watched, I know exactly what video you're talking about with the veteran and his jaw, watching that Ray. One. Yeah.
His name is Ray. Yeah,
exactly. And watching that going, what? Come really? On. This cannot be that legit. Like this, I thought exactly the same thing. And then the deeper I got into it, the more I saw more clients on my own, the more you're saying exactly what you said, that I just kept going back to body, body, body. And then of course, when I read Body Keeps the Score, that blew my brain wide open. Mm. That was just nuts. And then, ended up discovering polyvagal, and it was just like, everything clicks, everything makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. After I learned this, I could not help but see it. Mm. I don't think it was a confirmation bias thing. I think it's this new paradigm. Like it's this new way of seeing yourself but also how you interact with people. It's a new way of seeing others. And you know, I couldn't help but see my own kids through a new lens, my relationship with my wife, my relationship mm-hmm. with myself, the students I work with, the adults I work with, everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I could not unsee that in a way. I can't not, you know, see people as as nervous systems. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's a very unromantic totally. Way of putting it. But in a sense, I'm like, I recognize this, you know, in my clients when they would get more mobile, like I'm doing right now in my chair, like you get more mobile, you're leaning forward.
Yeah.
I would be like, oh, I know what's happening. Yeah. You know, if they're getting upset, I get it. I can conceptualize this now. And it's like, I'm not failing as a therapist when they get upset. That's just like some sympathetic energy either returning or maybe discharging. And now I can mentally contain it within myself because now I have a new paradigm. Mm-hmm. But I can also be there with them as they go through this, provide co-regulation. It's a very polyvagal concept. Mm-hmm. And it's things just are way more manageable for myself. And before, you know, our chat right here, I was in a pretty kind of dysregulated state. Like I just a lot of like tension inside of me, maybe caffeine driven. I had some coffee a couple hours ago and I just drink it like black. So it's like, it hits me. So it might've been it, but I also just kind of feel, I've been feeling the past few days just more tense at nighttime. Mm-hmm. And I can recognize that within myself. So I, rather than saying like, what's wrong with me? Or why can't I stop doing this? It's like, I'm kind of in this fight energy and maybe even a little bit of freeze. Cause it's kind of stuck in there. You know what I mean? It's not a full on freeze. I'm not like immobile. I'm not, you know, it's, but the energy, the flavor is there. And so now instead of blaming and judging, it's like, I just need to do some self-regulation before I talk with Heidi. Mm-hmm. And so I did some stretches, did some breathing. I laid on the floor. I probably looked like a weirdo to anybody who was, you know, walking by, but to me, it was like, I just need to like center myself and do some regulation. And so there was no judgment to it though. It's just like, this is just where I'm at, you know, whatever reasons, whether it's stress at work or whatever, like that's just where I'm at. And that's okay. You know what I mean? I don't know how I got here, but it's judgment free, I guess, is the basic idea.
Yeah, totally. But I think that's it. Like you just summed it up in a nugget there of why we love polyvagal is you, by teaching people the theory, you're enabling them to have a judgment-free space for themselves and others and their children and understanding of their behavior. Why am I doing this? Why are they doing this? And it's not laden with resentment and frustration and whatever. It's just, oh, that's just where they are on the ladder. Oh, that's just how their nervous system is responding. Less they're being manipulative. They're crying to try to get me to do something or whatever. It's like, they just, you start to see people more compassionately, I think. And it frees you up then to have more capacity. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't really add into that. Yeah. It's just, exactly.
So if we have people listening to this that are like super, super rookie with polyvagal, and they're like, I don't even know what the word means, Heidi and Justin, what are you even talking about? If you and I have clients and we want to go, okay, here's a little 101 episode. Your website is awesome. Your website has a lot of great breakdown kind of ways to explain it. But for people who are more audible and how they learn, how do you explain it? You know, I was saying to you before, I have the Winnie the Pooh is at the top of the ladder, Tigger's in the middle, Eeyore's at the bottom. How do you explain it when you are telling people how polyvagal, what it is, like starting from basics, what is it?
Well, the caveat here is it depends on what age group I'm talking to. You know what I mean? And the level of readiness when it comes to that. So I'll just caveat that. When I talk about this stuff with my teenage clients, I basically sum it up. Usually they're interested in how they respond to danger. And so I sum it up as, look, our bodies, and I don't use the word polyvagal. I don't use the word neuroception. Kills me not to, but it's not necessary when at a basic level. So with teenagers, I'll sum it up as, our bodies, they respond to being safe and being in danger in different ways. And if I have them interested in that, because they're not always interested, if they're interested enough, it's like, sometimes people, when they're in danger, they feel like running away. Sometimes people feel like fighting. And sometimes people feel like collapsing or shutting down, or sometimes you get like really tense, like a statue. And those concepts are easy enough and they kind of get that. And it's like, they start to put pieces together from their own life. And I'll explain, it's not just like we choose this stuff. No one's choosing to do these things. No one's choosing to socially engage or to run away or to have the impulse to run away. No one's choosing this stuff. And it's kind of like, it just happens. And it really happens in the sequence, like on a ladder. I'll give them the polyvagal ladder metaphor from Deb Dana. And I'll share like, here's this idea of a ladder where, you know, at the top of the ladder, we feel safe and social. And if we can't be safe and social, then we drop down the ladder into flight, fight, and then into shutdown. And so just basic bare bones concepts. And for them, that's usually enough for them if they're interested, because they're not always interested, but that's usually enough for them to be like, oh, like when I go home, I feel this way. Or they'll say, when I'm in school, I feel this way. And I can ask things like, hey, anybody in your life where you feel top of the ladder, like safe, like you actually feel some level of trust or calmness or maybe relaxation. And they'll usually say no. With the kids I work with, it's very extreme situations as far as neighborhood and family functioning, drug use, gang involvement. Like it's just inner city kind of stuff. So usually they'll say no. There's no one that they have in their life that's like that. And there usually is somebody, but you kind of have to push a little bit. And I'll say, well, how about a school? I know that we're not your family exactly, but you do spend a lot of time here. Any staff that you kind of feel okay around? And there usually is a teacher, but they don't think about it until you kind of prompt them. And so it's like, oh yeah, there is that one teacher that I do feel, like actually, I don't mind talking to them. And I do feel kind of safe around, or they'll think back to the past and be like, well, you know, my grandma passed away, but she was that person for me. So just basic concepts, they'll put pieces together and it builds a new narrative for them. Because when I say it's not like they think that they choose these things. I had a teenage boy, he was, I want to say like 15, 16, who got jumped. He got beat up pretty bad. And he felt really proud of himself because he had this adrenaline surge and he didn't feel any pain and he got out of the situation. So very political stuff happening, but he felt like I did this. And yeah, you did. And I didn't break his spirit and say like, yeah, but it's just political shit.
Totally.
I didn't explain like, well, you feel numb because of this and that adrenaline shift happened because of that. And but for him, it's like, I did this. I chose to do these things and
I was brave. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. In a sense, sure. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, it's like, ah, it's just biology, but you can't mm-hmm. do that. So, but that's their understanding of these things, whether they are a victor and they get out of a situation or they're the victim and they survive something and they think, I did this, or why didn't I do that? Or why didn't I respond by being more aggressive? Why didn't I fight off? Whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so this latter stuff for teenagers, it, in very simple terms, it removes that judgment stuff. And now it's this new way of looking at themselves. So that's how I explain it to teenagers. I mean, just very bare bone stuff. And then they start to get interested and then we kind of develop. When I present to teachers, I get a little bit more complex, but the simpler, the better. It kills me, Heidi, it kills me, but I was recommended by someone, don't use the word neuroception, keep it as simple as possible. Mm. And I'm like, but it's a special term he created just for this concept that's not available anywhere else really. And so I removed that, but I removed like ventral vagal and dorsal vagal, all the stuff that makes us feel super smart. I took it all out and I just left the bare bone stuff, but you can go a long, long, long way with that. And it's so intriguing to people. Like it's like it makes sense. I think it speaks to us on a very biological, basic level. Like it just, I think it does. Mm-hmm. And so they naturally want to learn more. And so you can, from bare bones, you can cultivate it after that. And then people put pieces together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, that's kind of how I, from teenagers or adults, that's usually the angle I come from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's cool. I agree with you that the core of it is safe, like, and safety. And that's like, whenever I'm explaining it to parents or teachers and the slide I have, what it says is, we need to feel safe before we can learn. That's like the foundation to everything. Like I'm doing a lot of webinars right now on lockdown and pandemic consequences and all that sort of thing. And the thing I always go back to is safety, 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 that our kids have to feel safe with us first and foremost. And you don't fixate on if they're doing homeschooling, if their room is clean, you got to go safety first and then you can do all the other stuff. But like you have nothing if you're not focusing on the safety first. And the thing I totally agree with you too, is when we start getting into that big language, it makes people shut off. I think they're just like, I don't know what you're talking about. And Porges, as much as I love him, sometimes I watch his stuff and I'm like, oh my God, you lost me. And I know this stuff. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about now. Yeah. So yeah, I agree with you that keeping it simple. Like I don't even use the terms parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous. Like I don't even talk about that when I talk to parents and teachers, because I found it really hard to get my head around it when I was first learning what the two meant and wait, which does what, you know?
For sure. Even when I'm reading through, I attempted to read his book, The Polyvagal Theory. And I'm like, I got 50 pages deep and I'm like, I'm out. I'll stick to the lectures. He has the clinical applications with Deb Dana, and then he has and other writers. And then he has the pocket guide, and that was good enough. His lectures, a couple of his essays, and I put the pieces together, but I've gotten to a place where I'm like, no, I want to take a step further.
Yeah.
And it's dense. It is extremely, extremely complex.
Yeah.
And there's so much to it. There's heart stuff and the parasympathetic stuff and breathing and heart rate. And it's a ton of not necessary stuff, but it's like, I call it nerd points, trauma nerd or polyvagal nerd points. And when we do our presentations, we'll put like safe and social in the heading. And then right next to it in smaller letters, it'll say ventral vagal parasympathetic in like quote or in parentheses. And we say, hey, just for nerd cred, here you go. This is what it's called.
Totally. Yeah. For those of you that are really keen and want to learn more. Yeah. So one of the things that I think is, you mentioned a second ago, that I thought was really exciting when I discovered it as well, was because I also specialize in trauma, and a lot of the kids and families I've worked with and adults have experienced sexual abuse. That blew my mind when I first learned about polyvagal and the shutdown state, to the common question that people would have of, why didn't I respond differently? Why didn't I run away? Why didn't I push them off? Why didn't I fight more? I just completely laid there, you know, or I got numb, or I checked out. I started thinking about what I was going to do tomorrow while this was happening, or, you know, so many people would say that to me. And it was so cool, once I understood polyvagal, to be like, this is why. Can I explain it to you? So how do you, again, because we have people who are totally new to this, when someone says that to you, like, why didn't I respond, Justin? Why didn't I push them away? Why didn't I run? How do you explain it? And let's go with young people. Let's go with adolescents and stuff. Yeah. How do you explain it to them of, this is why? Let me tell you what your body and your brain were doing in that moment.
If they're asking why, like, that's a clear entry point to talk about the latter. And like, when I hear the why, I'm like, I have answers for you. Because before then, it's more about, you know, listening, understanding, building, you know, rapport. And you don't really jump in with, here's some psychoeducation for you. Mm-hmm. Or I don't, at least. So when I hear why, it's like, I'm ready. And so we'd go through the latter scenario. That's really the time for me to like kind of share that. So it's like, well, why? It's not a choice. It's, here's the sequence of events. And it kind of comes down to, what is our individual body neurocepting or detecting as an appropriate or needed response in order to survive? So it comes down to survival. And if our bodies aren't detecting that we can utilize flight or fight to get to safety, to get the danger to back off, then freeze and or shutdown are kind of the only options left. And I really reframe it as biology, not choice. And that it's about survival. Like, your body did what it was supposed to, like what it was evolved to do. And that's a really good thing. And so when you put it that way, I think there's a level of gratitude. And I don't know if that's the right word. Appreciation, maybe. That the person, and I've had, especially the girls I work with that go through sexual assaults, or there is this sense of like, oh, the judgment's lifted. And it's like, that makes sense now. There was someone I was working with, trigger warning for anybody who needs it, definitely want to respect that. But she had been the victim of severe sexual abuse by a couple different blankety blanks. I'll keep it clean. And she got to the point where shutdown was basically her daily existence, very disconnected, very dissociative, very numb. And she kind of had to, in order to survive in her life that she was born into. There's a story that she kind of went to as we were talking about this stuff. And she said she was worried her sister would also be a victim of these people or this person in that scenario. And so she said, I remember, again, trigger warning for people, please. But she said, I remember like volunteering myself as a sacrifice so that my sister just got to be a kid and play in the backyard. And she's like, before knowing dissociation and shutdown and numbness that come along with the dorsal vagal shutdown and being and living in that state and having that be a potential viable response. Before that, it was like, why did I do that? And at that age, she was exploring sexuality with partners, you know, whatnot. And so to have what she was considering sexual experiences along with new, more normalized sexual experiences, tons of confusion and self-blame and shame and guilt. And I don't blame her. So that you take that like disgust and the shame and the questioning of like, why, and wanting an explanation to now I have an explanation and it makes sense. And it normalizes in a way what was happening within, not the context of what was happening, but within the individual who went through whatever they went through, no matter what that is, it normalizes their response to it. Yeah, it comes a sense of gratitude or feeling like less like a victim, maybe more like a survivor in a way. I don't know the right words. I want everyone who hears this to feel validated and to feel like that's my goal of my podcast is to appease everybody to say, not appease, but like everyone hears it and they get it and they feel validation and they feel normalized. But so I'm doing the best I can, but I think for her, that was an experience of learning about the ladder and herself and how that relates to her is seeing herself more like, oh, well, it makes sense now. It makes sense now why I did that. And rather than seeing myself just as a victim, now there is this level of survivor, hero in a way. And again, the context is horrific, but for her, that was a part of it. You know what I mean?
Totally. I think that is the key with like the gift of polyvagal is that you get to give these people this gift of reframing.
Yeah.
Like, dude, the way you responded was genius because you were surviving. It was your brain doing what it does really well, which is survive. It was actually really smart. It wasn't weak, stupid, shameful. Right. It was really, really smart because you survived. And hello, like, look at you now. Like you're here. You survived 100% of your days. So it's like, you can't shit on your brain for being like that or your nervous system. It's like, dude, it was doing its job. It was trying to keep you alive and it worked. Another thing that I just thought of when you were saying that was the number of male clients I've had that experienced abuse perpetrated by another man and grew up a lot of their life wondering if they were gay. Because I didn't, same thing. I didn't fight it. I didn't push back. I didn't run away. There must be something wrong with me. And again, going back to, it's a physiological response. It's a biological response. The way that you are wired to get through scary events or events that you neurocept and your brain interprets as being, and your nervous system interprets as not being safe is to just survive. And it doesn't matter what that looks like. It's often not what you think is like what it should look like. It's your body just acting and responding. And I loved it when you said on one of your posts ages ago, and it just really, really hit me was the, and you say this a lot is it is not a menu of options. It's a sequence of events. Yeah. Can you just explain that, like deep dive a little bit more into that of what that means when we say that? Because I think a lot of survivors of any kind of trauma go, oh, well then once they learn polyvagal, oh, okay, well, so it's a menu. I would like to pick safe social. Thank you. You know, like I don't want to have shutdown. I don't want to have fight flight. Like, let's just stick with safe social. Yeah. How do you explain the doesn't work like that? How do you explain that?
It's the ladder analogy. And on a ladder, you can't exactly skip a rung. You carefully, you know, go one by one by one. And so at the top of our ladder is a safe and social state. And the ladder is a metaphor. There's no actual ladder inside of us. It's a metaphor for the way these states are built within us, like literally biologically. And at the top of our bodies, but on the top of our polyvagal ladder is the safe and social state. That circuitry goes from brainstem to face to heart, neck muscles. It lives up, you know, at the top. And so that's the top of the ladder. The sympathetic flight fight system lives in the chest. Lies his arms and legs for evasion and aggression. That's in the middle of the ladder is our chest. The bottom of the ladder is our gut. And that's where that dorsal vagal shutdown system lives. You feel these when they're active. You can feel them. You can feel your heartbeat picking up. You can feel your muscles tense when you're in a shutdown or when that's activated. You feel your stomach maybe twist, or there's like acid spikes or emptiness. It's different for different people, but you feel these sensations in these locations. When you're in a safe and social state, you can feel your face come to life. You smile, your eyebrows are being able to move now, rather than your eyes have crinkles when you listen, rather than just being open and creepy. So, so that's the ladder is a metaphor for how it's built within us. Ideally, we want to be at the top of our polyvagal ladder, but if we can't, we go down. We don't just jump straight to shutdown. It might, when people tell these stories, for them, it seems like it, but when you break the story down, they can recognize, oh, I did feel that impulse to run. And maybe in the moment I wasn't cognizant of it, or there was just distractions or more going on, but yeah, there was that impulse to run. Like I did feel that little something. And so if you can't run away, then you shift down to the fight. So flight and fight are both sympathetic. But as I understand it from Peter Levine and Dr. Porges, it's flight first and then fight. And I know I've read this a couple of times. I'm terrible at noting where I get information from because I'm so into just like learning, but it's flight then fight. And the reason for that is because we basically want to get away from, if we can't be safe, we want to get away from danger. We don't want to get closer to it. We want to get away from it. But if we can't get away from it, that's when we use aggression and get closer to it and do things like throw and push, so that we can then get away from it. So if we can use aggression to push or throw or whatever, to encroach upon space, even like having a louder voice or like leaning forward, if we can posture aggression, that might be enough to get that threat to back off. And then we utilize flight, get the heck out of there, back to our families or to safety or wherever it is. So if we can't be safe, we go to flight, fight. If we can't run away, we can't fight, then we drop down. In polyvagal terms, we drop down to the shutdown state where we collapse. So it's a ladder. We go all the way down. We could also do this thing where it's shutdown plus flight fight, which is freeze, where we tense up and immobilize. That's a different type of immobilization than shutdown, which is a collapse immobilization. But it's a ladder. So we go down. It's a sequence of events. We do one after the other. And it might not be like we're throwing hands fighting. But if we really look back and say, like, no, that there was this like impulse to do something, I did feel my muscles tense up because my body did want to do something, right? I did raise my voice. I did do these things that, you know, were down my ladder one by one. Okay. Usually we can identify pretty clearly, like there were these moments, but it's a ladder. So you can't just go from the bottom to the top either. You have to go through each state in the reverse sequence. And that would be coming out of that immobilization up into a mobilization, the flight fight system, fight first and then flight, because it's the reverse. And I see this all the time with my clients where they're presenting in a very shut down, disconnected, numb place. And as we do therapy, they get the co-regulation from me. They feel some energy come back in their system. And it's not uncommon for them to feel irritability. And when they go home, they'll recognize, like, I'm just sort of snapping at people more, or I feel more irritable. I feel more aggressive. And that is potentially a very good thing. That healthy aggression can be as long as it's not out of control, as long as it's not, you know, coming out of freeze and into a rage or something like that, that's different. But you come out of that shutdown, that immobilization, up into flight, fight, fight first, and then flight. And one of these might be more dominant than the other, but fight, then flight. And so you'll feel that more anxious kind of energy. And then if you can deal with that, then you bump up all the way to the top of the ladder, which is the safe and social state. This ladder climbing, descending and ascending it's a sequence. That's the order, in the reverse order you kind of have to go through. But it can happen fairly quickly. It doesn't mean that you stay at the top of the ladder. So in therapy, during that hour, it's not uncommon for someone to climb their ladder, make eye contact with me, have their eyes squint, smile. We share laughter together. Not uncommon whatsoever, pretty rapidly, but maintaining that, holding that, you have to kind of build the capacity to do so. That's the idea when it comes to this ladder stuff and the sequence of events. So it's not like we're picking from a menu of options. No, it's not a conscious thing. There's no conscious weighing of, should I go into my fight mode during this situation or should I go into a shutdown? Like, no one's doing that. It just kind of happens. based on what your body's neurocepting is necessary and going through that sequence of events down and, but also back up.
I think that's a great way to explain it. And I think it is really helpful too for parents and teachers to understand that, because I always say to them, as your child is or student is passing back up, right? So, you know, you want them to get back to safe social, but you got to buckle up for what that means. That doesn't mean that they're going to be a little sweetheart. Like, it means that if they're coming out, if they're way at the bottom, then that means we're going to pass through some behaviors, some things that they might say, some hitting, kicking, spitting, whatever, as they're on their way back up. That oftentimes what I see happen with parents is they tell me a story about a situation of behavior with their kid. And then they say, and then he started hitting me and he started, you know, kicking me. And so then I'm like, oh God, what'd you do? And then they're like, and so I yelled at him, stop it. Don't you do that. Or I hit him or I locked him in his room or whatever. And I'm like, oh, you pushed him right back down the ladder. Unknowingly, of course, you pushed him right back down the ladder when little dude was trying to come back up. His nervous system was trying to bring him up. And that's, I find, a common one with parents and anger is because none of us were raised by parenting experts or, you know, Dan Siegel's not my dad. None of us know how to do that. And so we're all rookies, right? So we're all winging it and parenting based on how we were parented. So then what do? We yell, we get angry, and then we push them back down. And then they come and see me and go, I don't know why my kid has rage issues. And I'm like, how did you handle it? What was your anger management in that moment? And the concept too, that you mentioned just then about co-regulation. I mean, when I learned about that, like, whoa, did your brain not explode when you learned like mirror neurons and like, what? Can you explain a little bit about what co-regulation means? I mean, you and I know that from being in the room in a therapeutic setting that often we co-regulate people and they don't realize that that's what we're doing. Can you explain for parents, clinicians, teachers, what co-regulation is and why it's so important for us to remain calm?
I think that we know, people know that remaining calm or being as well regulated as grounded as possible is a good thing. As a therapist before knowing polyvagal theory, I knew there's something about the way I am in session that has to do with therapy. There's something about me being in a well-regulated place, me noticing where I'm at, and being well regulated that seems to help. Like I didn't have the words for it, but it had something to do with, I could feel these things happening within me. And I could feel like if I'm in a decent place, like they seem to do better. You know what I mean? So I think that if we're introspective enough, like we kind of get that, at least consciously, we know that we affect each other and that's the essence of co-regulation. But polyvagal theory goes a step further and kind of pinpoints names the biological things that we do to signify to each other that we're safe. That's what it comes down to. Co-regulation doesn't happen unless we have between the two people, one person who's in a well-regulated, safe, enough. I don't expect myself to be a perfect parent. I wish I was. I know this stuff. I've taught parents. I make mistakes. Like, I don't expect perfection. I'm not beating up on parents who aren't perfect. I'm with you. Okay. Like, for real. So in order to have co-regulation, one of the people in that dyad has to be well regulated enough, have enough access to their safe and social state. Because when they do, they will naturally, co-regulation isn't like a tool that we can kind of consciously, we can be aware of it, but it's not like we can manipulate someone unless you're a sociopath maybe. But the basic idea is if you're actually in your well regulated safe and social state, you will naturally give cues of safety to the other person. You will naturally do things like squint your eyes when you listen. You will utilize your eyebrows to show interest like you're doing right now. You'll nod your head. You'll tilt your head to the side to show like I'm interested. You'll smile. You will make noises to show you're listening like, you'll have this thing called vocal prosody, which is the ability to use your voice to go up like higher pitch, like I'm asking a question, but you'll also use your voice to go down and to show like this is really serious stuff here, you know? So all of these things are biological. All of these things come from us having access to our safe and social state. from these certain pathways, the ventral vagal pathways being active. So all these facial muscles, we can now use them. And if we can do that, then we are naturally going to give cues to the other person that's with us that, hey, I'm a safe mammal. And that other person's brainstem, their senses will pick up on this and go in the brainstem. The brainstem will detect, hopefully, safety and help the other person to climb their own polyvagal ladder, hopefully up into their safe and social state. Mm-hmm. But one of us needs to be in a well-regulated place in order to give those cues of safety. And hopefully the other one can pick them up. Someone who's in more of a traumatized, stuck defensive state, they pick up on them, but it's more challenging to accept it, to feel okay with it, because it's very uncomfortable potentially. When they, in therapy, when they pick up my cues of safety and they climb to the top of their ladder and they begin to feel things like trust or vulnerability or exposure, feeling exposed, can be very unsettling. You know what I mean? So we have to kind of build the capacity to pick up co-regulation and feel okay with it and maintain our own level of, or their own level of our own level of safety and social engagement. So that's the basic idea of co-regulation. It's not like parents need to just have more vocal prosody and you're good, or make more genital eye contact. Those are pieces of it, but it's not exactly something you can fake. I think it's something like if you're genuinely well regulated, your kids will pick up on that. You will exude that. It'll come off of you. Like it'll naturally come off of you. So the goal is not to just do these pieces. You know what I mean? The goal is not to just speak with more prosody. The goal is to be well regulated enough to where the prosody naturally comes. And then your child will pick up on that, which will help. It doesn't solve everything, but it will help them to eventually self-regulate, but it'll help them to climb their own polyvagal ladder, which will lead to their own self-regulation. The more that's practiced and noticed and felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. That's a good explanation of co-regulation.
Yeah. Right.
I think too, something that is relevant here is, explaining that is often the power of therapy and the power of a mm-hmm. good therapist. And as we both know, there are a lot of crap therapists out there and lots of therapists that it's horrifying that they're practicing. But when you get a good therapist that has done their own work, knows their own ladder, knows themselves, is clear on their own stuff and knows how to regulate, it can be magical for so many people and I'm sure you've heard this. I've heard this a million times, especially working with the traumatized population, is Heidi, Justin, you're the first person I've ever mm-hmm. actually felt safe with.
100%. Totally.
And it's heartbreaking, but it's also, yay, you have won. Your body and your brain and your nervous system get to see what it's like to be opposite someone that you feel safe with, that you can share things and I'm not going to judge you. You can share, like I've had clients who will say, push back on something like, this appointment time doesn't work for me. Could we change it to another time? And be so nervous and so scared to ask for something or to say how they feel. Or you said something last week that kind of hurt my feelings, or I was thinking about it a lot. And I just wanted to share that with you. And then having this kind of beautiful moment where you get to go, this is what a healthy relationship looks like. This is what safety looks like. Yeah. You can tell me how you feel. I'm not going to bite your head off. It's safe to do that. And that I think is a really great point that you just highlighted, that when people say like, yeah, I have friends to talk to, or I can talk to my mom. It's like, yeah, but sometimes therapy is where you can get a real experience of a safe social.
It's different. Yeah.
Yeah. It's different.
Yeah, totally. There's no, like outside of therapy, people can listen and be supportive. Absolutely. But there's like sometimes an agenda to it, and maybe not like a manipulative one, but there is emotional involvement. It saddens me to say that I am probably more empathetic. Please don't hate me for this. Right. I'm probably more empathetic, understanding, patient with my clients than I am with anybody else, including my own kids. And I hate to say that.
For sure. Same. Yeah. Same.
Okay, good. All right. So same. Like with my, like there's emotional investment. Like there's probably some ego stuff involved in here. There's like who I am. There's my own, the way I was parented. And we bring all that to the relationship of being a parent. And that's true. And so that is kind of an obstacle to me being that wonderfully empathetic, super patient person. But in therapy, it's like, it ends after the hour. As a parent, it doesn't end. Exactly. Mm-hmm. In therapy, there's a professional relationship and there's a goal that we're working on. In parenting, it's not like it's so different. And so, yeah, we can get support from anybody and everybody, but the therapy relationship, it should be pretty special. It should be distinct. It should have a different feel to it. It really, really should. It should not be like advice giving. And I do this thing called bad therapy on the podcast, and we break down,
love it.
We break down these stories that people send me. And it's horrifying, horrifying.
Totally. The analogy I always use for people when they say, oh, I tried therapy, but I didn't like it. I'm like, you hated the therapist, not therapy. Because if you have good therapy,
yeah,
it's awesome. And the analogy I always use is when you're trying to find a therapist, you have to shop around. It's a bit like finding a life partner. You don't marry the first one you date. You have to date a few till you find one you want to marry. And that what the feeling you want is you leave the session going, that's someone I'd like to have a coffee with. That's someone that I feel comfortable, or I'd have a beer with, you know, someone that I just, I enjoy their company. Because as you and I know, especially with trauma work, the relationship is everything. Like it doesn't matter. So many other things that are happening. It's that in this relationship, I feel safe, seen, heard, valid, not judged, not criticized, like loved. I feel cared for in this relationship. Respected.
Cared about. Totally. Yeah. It's all these pieces that maybe not admired, but I feel like admiration is a part of love. So, but in therapy, there is like respect, there's caring, there's unconditional positive regard. That's a pretty important one. Like no matter what you bring up, I can still understand on some level, or I can still care. I can still, I'm here for you still. Like it's not going to scare me away, you know? It's not really true anywhere else. I mean, yes and no, no matter what my kids do, I'll still be there for them, but it's just different.
Totally. Yeah. It's the therapeutic relationship is unlike any other because we have no agenda. Ideally. Yeah. You don't reflect on me. I don't, it's like, it's different to our kids where there's an ego thing of like feeling like they reflect on us or whatever. But, and I think, God, I need to listen to those, bad therapy ones because I agree that dude, the number of stories I've heard where like always in a first session, I'll say to people like, so what's your experience with therapy? Have you had therapy before? And then, and why didn't that work out? Or why aren't you seeing them? And then when they tell me the stories, I'm like, they said what? Like, you can't do that. Like, ooh, it's horrifying. And so many people don't know that that's not how it's supposed to be. Like that is messed up, man. Like that's not okay. Like and we need to report them.
Completely. Right. Sometimes it does have that feel of like there's a continuum where I've heard from too many teen clients that the person they saw before me was like on their phone during session. And that's stupid. Like that's bad therapy, but it's not like, I mean, that's dumb. Like it's not therapy, but it's not, I don't want to go into specifics. It's not like abusive.
Yeah.
And there's stories I get from my listeners where it's like, that was abusive. That was manipulative. You took advantage of that person and like you took advantage of that person and they sadly did not know otherwise because we know the norms of therapy, the ethics, the literal like rules and laws.
Yes. The do's and don'ts.
We know what's legally appropriate, ethically appropriate, but also just clinically what's appropriate. Like they don't know that. And so there's so much trust. And it is sadly a relationship that is, I don't want to put it this way, but I don't know how else to put it. It can be with the wrong person, easy to exploit because there's someone saying, I need help. I'm desperate. Here's all my shit that I've been through. And you have someone else, if it's the wrong person who can easily manipulate that. And it's like, it's mind boggling the amount of responsibility that we bring to our relationship with our client, or we should.
Yes.
It's like, it's kind of like intimidating in a way. It's like we should be treating this as a very breakable, very special thing, this relationship. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But so many are just like on their phone or giving stupid advice or not really listening, not really understanding or doing downright abusive things. And it's did this thing on Instagram. It's been a couple of years, I think, where I had started to get from my listeners, just bad therapy. And I'm like, really? I'd heard from my in-person clients, and it was just dumb stuff. But then I heard like actually bad stories. And like, how prevalent is this? Cause I didn't really know. And so I put it out on Instagram in my stories and just said, hey, do you have any bad therapy examples? And let people, and there was just like example after example. And it was daunting. I got so many responses. It was like this feeling of like disgust and of like shock. And I honestly, like a part of me was like kind of numb to like all of the horrible examples I was getting. And like, it pissed me off. Honestly, there was like some numbness there that was pissed off. Shock. I mean, just like a number of things that I went through in seeing just one, like bam, 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 one after the other. And what I did was, I know we're totally off on a tangent. Hope that's okay.
I love tangents.
Okay. What I did was I shared every single one of those in the stories, made it like anonymous, and people loved it because it was like, oh, that's not normal. Like exposing it, putting it out in the sunlight and being like, okay, here's a bad therapy example of someone who touched their client. I'm not going to go any further than that. But people were like, oh, you know what I mean? Or here's an example of just stupid advice. And they were like, people wrote to me saying, I didn't know that wasn't, giving advice is not really the norm of therapy. In my opinion, I don't give advice to my clients. I'm not them. I don't live their life. In my opinion, just saying, yeah, just do this. Like that's not therapy. But that is a very common experience. So once you put it in the light and people are, and I've gotten nothing but positive responses from my bad therapy series, except from therapists. Therapists don't like me doing this. A few of them have written me saying, you shouldn't do this. You're going to scare away clients. And I'm like, what? What? It's just, it's, I don't know. I get pissed off. Wow. And get upset. I'm going to leave it as is. Therapists have had problems with this. Not people, the people, clients are appreciative, or prospective clients are appreciative.
Totally.
And I like that. I like transparency. So
I agree. And I think they need, I think it's what it is you're informing people, and people don't know what they don't know. And so they maybe don't realize that this is not how it works in therapy. And then when you are bringing that into the light,
they should. Like, how could they?
Totally. Where are you supposed to learn what it's like without living it and doing it, you know, yourself? I totally agree with you. That's so powerful, because it kills me so many times when I meet someone that's like in their, I don't know, 50s or 60s, that when I say like, have you done therapy before? They'll say, oh yeah, I tried it in my 20s or my 30s or, you know, before. And what was it like? Oh, he just shamed me a lot, or she just judged me a lot, or told me I must leave him. If I didn't leave my abusive relationship, she wasn't going to see me anymore. Like so many of those stories, you know? Or like, you just need to get back out there and date. I'm not going to see you again until you get out on your first date. Like just these really crazy, crazy stories that just made me sad that like, God, you were living with all this pain and carrying all of this hurt and wounding. And then this clinician just like screwed it up, you know, just, I'm with you. It makes me riled up as well. And yeah, people don't know. They don't know. So they stick with it. I mean, years. I have clients who've said, I saw her for 5 years. And I'm like, why did you see her for 5 years? Like, and they're like, cause I didn't know. I didn't want to start again with someone. So,
So what I've found with these bad therapy stories is it seems like with the ones I've reviewed on the podcast, and you'll hear me like, I do them with, she used to be a co-host, Sadie's Corona. She and I will break down these stories. And it seems like a lot of times there are what I would call, I don't know if I'm using this correctly, but a parallel process where the person comes in with whatever they went through, whatever flavor, whatever themes. And then that gets repeated by the therapist as far as taking advantage of them or manipulating them in some way. And it's like a mirror image, it seems like. And so there's, to bring it back to polyvagal theory, clients come in defensive states, stuck defensive states, trauma. They come in down their ladder. They need, we all need, all of us, we need co-regulation as part of climbing our, until we have enough self-regulation maybe, but even then, like we need each other. And so they go to someone who they have this assumption of being safe, assumption of being professional. And these should be accurate stories, thoughts. There should be some level of hope here, right? So there are, like, they come in defensive state and put these positive expectations onto the person they're hiring. And that's appropriate. That's a good thing. As long as the person on the other side of that is able to respect that and treat that with a lot of love and care. And so they come in and it's like their well-being and literally their emotional health, their well-being. They're saying like, I'm trusting you with this. Mm. You know what I mean? I'm trusting you to help me climb my poly. Mm-hmm. They don't say this, but I'm trusting you to help me get to their biology is saying, their brainstem is saying like, we need safety. They're looking for it. I've picked mm-hmm. you. You have all the credentials. You got the stuff on your wall, the letters after your name. You have pretty pictures on Instagram or on your website. Your blog says the right, whatever it is.
Totally.
And so it's like, they're bringing this and they're saying, I trust you, please. And their biology, I think, is expecting co-regulation, safety, to be able to be emotionally held as contained, mm-hmm. to be able to feel their shit and have that contained mm-hmm. by someone who's still okay with them and okay yeah. with themselves. And that can go really, really well or really, really wrong with the wrong person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. One other thing I wanted to touch on before we wrap up is, how do I get back up the ladder is probably one of the most common things I hear whenever I talk about polyvagal. And yeah. one of the quick list is like being calm, or if my kid is at the bottom of the ladder, what should I do with them? Or, you know, if myself, and I always give the quick list, which is like being calm, safe, regulated yourself. If you're sitting opposite someone who's dysregulated, the basic stuff that everyone kind of knows of like meditation, breathing, rest, nature, exercise, da, da, da. A few things on my list are the don'ts, like minimize, invalidate, shame, dismiss, yeah. that kind of stuff. And doing that to yourself as well, raising your voice, that doesn't help people go. But like when you were saying at the beginning of like, you were feeling a little dysregulated and you laid on the floor and you were doing some breathing, what are your like favorite kind of go-tos for yourself? And then when you explain this to people you work with, what are some of your favorite go-tos of, if you're feeling dysregulated, either in the middle or the bottom of the ladder, how do you like to encourage people to get back up?
So I agree with everything you said as far as like here's some general stuff. And that has its use, but it's also very frustrating because it's someone might be like, well, I don't like yoga. I don't like meditation. I don't feel safe doing these things. Like, what are you talking about, Justin? And so my typical answer is when I ask like, how do I climb my ladder? I'm like, I don't know. Cause I'm not you. I have no idea what speaks to you and your specific nervous system. That's really what it comes down to. I mean, when I do therapy with my students, I have a basket of fidgets in the room, and I could easily say like, here, just use this fidget and like really feel it and like utilize that fight energy maybe, which is true and can be helpful. But that person, whatever fidget I give them, might be like, yeah, that feels right. Or they might feel like, no, this is way wrong. I even had a student, I gave him a green fidget, and I'm not going to go into it, but the color green brought them these feelings of nauseousness. So that fidget for one person, not based on color, but just based on the fidget itself, might be like, oh, thank you so much. And now I can discharge my energy and life is perfect. But the next person can't even get past the sight of it. So for me just to be like, yeah, here's a fidget. You're good. Here's a technique. Take a cold shower or extend the exhale. All these things might be helpful, but they might not. Telling someone who's in a shutdown state to extend their exhale might be helpful, but they're also not breathing very fast. They're not breathing into their chest. They don't really exactly have to slow down their exhale. They're probably breathing in a very shallow way. Mm-hmm. So encouraging them to just be mindful of that, feel it, allow themselves to be still, notice what it feels like to feel empty or to have that void in that pit in your stomach. That might go farther. You know what I mean? Encouraging them to listen to silence or to listen to very low, soft music. That could be a lot more helpful than do a yoga pose, but yoga might be helpful. I don't know. Like it's so individualized. And what I would encourage people to do is this is where you can make a menu of options. And this is Deb Dana recommends this as well, is like literally create a menu of options. And just as you see these things on Instagram, people saying, yeah, do I'm laughing because I think about dancing therapists. I don't know if you're one of the dancing therapists or not. there's all these therapists and coaches on Instagram that they dance and they put it in their TikToks and whatever.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not one of those.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, not with us.
And I love, I'm not dude. Like.
I know.
Okay. Yeah. I respect it. You do you. I am not, right, stop here. I can't do that. I can't even look at it. Like, I feel embarrassed. I'm not a dancer.
Too. I know.
Thank you. Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know where I went with that, but as you see these people saying, be silly and dance, for me, I'm like, no. No, I'm not going to do that. Stop.
Totally.
For someone else, it might be like, that's what I need. Yes. Thank you. So take that dancing therapist's recommendation and write it down. That's on your menu and then try it out. And if you like it, put a check mark by it. That's a possibility for self-regulation. And then as someone tells you to splash water in your face, cold water, or take a cold shower, or meditate, or do a certain yoga pose. If you feel like, oh, there might be something, if you feel curious or you feel a pull in that direction, write it down and try it out. If it feels right, keep it on the list. If it's a clear no, take it off a list, right? So now you have this menu of options. Cool. Now the next step would be to notice what works in what state. So before I did this with you, I was on the floor stretching out and I don't do yoga, but I'm like, I think what I'm doing looks like yoga. I think this is called like downward dog or something like that. I have no idea, but it just felt right. I just listened to my body and it's like, I just need to move this way. I need to do this type of breathing, whatever. I just listened to my body and that gets me to where I need to be enough. Mm-hmm. So take these things. And the next time you're in a dysregulated state, try it out. But you kind of have to have some level of curiosity for that. So if you're in a very flight anxious state, and when someone's telling you to extend your exhale, see how it feels. Like, try it out. Just try it out. You know what I mean? And if that's a no, then you go to the next piece on the menu and rule it in or rule it out. And notice like, oh, this really helped me when I was in a more angry, aggressive, irritable place. Like this thing, you know, pushing. I do this a lot. Like just pushing in your hands. Like you feel the muscles tensing and then you relax them. So when I'm in a very aggressive kind of energy, irritable kind of place. Mm-hmm. And same with my clients, I recommend they do this. And it's like, that just feels right when I'm in this state. If I'm in a shutdown place, like using my muscles like that probably isn't going to go very far. Mm-hmm. I want probably more stillness. Actually, stillness is the wrong word because that's a mixed state. I want to immobilize. I want to be still and have lower stimulation. So doing push-ups is not going to go very far for me. Boxing is not going to go very far for me when I'm in a shutdown place. So I recommend people realize that there's no one answer. There might be things out there that are generally helpful, like extending your exhale, being in nature, stuff like that. You know, just those general things. Meditation generally, I think, is helpful. But for you in that state, I don't know. You'll have to kind of test it out and see how you feel about it.
Totally. I think the key that I just heard in what you said is don't be judgmental on yourself. Mm. What works for you may not work for me, or what works for 90% of the population may not work for you. Doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. Try different things and try different things in different combinations and different states, that it's not necessarily going to work in this state, but it might work in another state. And then I think with your children, also knowing when your kid is at a different place on the ladder, knowing that what they need in that moment might not be what your son needs, what your daughter needs might be different. And your firstborn and your thirdborn might it all be different. It's not necessarily that you need to go, oh, you should do candle breathing. Now pretend you're blowing out the candles with me. You know, like you don't have to necessarily do what the books or what you read on Instagram, dancing, you know, it doesn't have to be what everyone else says.
You don't. I have found actually the more well-regulated I am, the more I'm in my safe and social state, the more creative I get. And I'm a pretty creative person. Like I will naturally come up with ideas of how to help my kids out. One example is my son. When I'm in a dysregulated place, I'm not super helpful. It kind of does come down to like, dude, just go to bed. You know what I mean? Like, stop, go to bed. But when I'm at my best, I had this idea of like, why don't I just use his stuffed animals to like talk with him? You know what I mean? Very creative, very playful. And that has ended up being an almost nightly thing where he's like, let's do zombie talk because it's this Minecraft zombie. And so I'll pick up the zombie and I'll move his arms around and I move the thing's head around. It's just a stuffed animal, but I have fun with it. He feels my energy of having fun. It makes it okay to talk about the day or talk about feelings. And he loves talking to this freaking Minecraft zombie. That's awesome. So that's his way of decompressing every night. And it works. He's way more likely to just lay down and go to bed with less interruptions or no interruptions, no getting up to do whatever, no needing to be reminded that we're still here. He's in a more well-regulated place himself. And he's actually, was it yesterday, a couple nights ago? He said there was something, he was in a dysregulated place. He was upset at me for something, like, I don't know. I wouldn't color with him. Or I was in a place where I was like, dude, I need alone time. And I'm like, I'm just not there for you. Like, and I recognize that. So I'm like, I I'm sorry, dude, but I can't play with you. Like, I'm just not there. And he was upset about that. And he's like, he said something about, tonight I'm not gonna be able to go to sleep very fast. Like, I'm probably gonna get up because I don't feel like your love and stuff. He was saying something around there. I can't quote him, but it was like, this has ended up not being a good day. And now I won't be able to go to sleep easily, because he recognizes that he needs that connection before he can immobilize and go to sleep.
Yes. Yeah.
So anyhow, you'll get creative.
That's a good thing to explain too, is that, you know, the body is stepping into its most vulnerable position at night, right, when it's going to bed. And that's why kids need us to be, ideally, we can be safe, social, and connected with them at that time, because their nervous system knows, hang on, I'm about to go offline. I need to feel safe in my surroundings. And why so many kids act, quote unquote, naughty at bedtime and misbehave, quote unquote, because they are trying to get you to connect with them and trying to get you engage. And that's cool. I think the stuffed animal thing you do, I'm going to steal that and do that with my kids, because it's playful and it's easy to do. Right. It doesn't require getting on your hands and knees and crawling around like a lion. Like, it's actually doable, you know, it's easy.
Yeah.
Dude, it's been so fun talking to you. How do people find you, learn more? I know you have your Safety Anchors program and you have the podcast, but can you just run through all your stuff? We'll put it in the show notes too.
Sure.
But
thank you.
Run through all of your things and how people can work with you further.
Thank you for letting me kind of put that out there. So justinlmft.com is the website. It's also justinlmft is my Instagram handle. I just started YouTube, so I got a bunch of videos I'm putting out on YouTube as well. But if you just go to justinlmft.com, you'll find the blog and the podcast. All my stuff is kind of there, including my course, Building Safety Anchors. Like we talked about, like, I don't know the answer for any one person, but the course can help them. It guides them through 30 days of identifying, like, learning about what brings people to safety generally. So we talk about 6 different paths to finding safety, like music, using your senses, adjusting the environment, manipulating your environment. So how can you do these 6 different paths? But what does it look like for you? Like, I don't know the answer for you. You know what I mean? But in general, I can teach you about these things and then for 30 days, help you identify what works for you, practice it, notice it, feel it. So it's really about not looking at pain, not discharging trauma. It's not trauma work exactly. It's laying the foundations for feeling safe and to stay in your safety system, which could end up leading to people doing the more trauma discharging kind of stuff. But this is really about identifying safety and practicing it and noticing it. So Building Safety Anchors, that's on the website as well.
Oh, well, yay. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing your wisdom and all of this stuff and explaining some things. I always feel like talking to people who we talk about the same stuff is like, I don't know if you've ever heard the saying, there's no new messages, there's just new messengers. And the way that you explain something might be based on your life experience, you know, your parenting, your trauma, your whatever, that you will explain something in a different way that clicks, that I could have tried to explain the same thing, but it doesn't click. And the way that you say it is a cool way to explain the same message, but because you're a different messenger, it's cool and it's unique. So thank you for sharing that with us today.
You're super welcome. Yeah, you're totally right. Though, even though it's like you hear the same thing, it just sounds different the next time or with that certain person. It's like, and then it's like, oh, now it makes sense. So yeah, hopefully I can bring that to people. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
If you're a parent or a professional who works with children and you want my help in improving things with the kiddos in your life, or if you're simply a human being feeling kind of stuck and maybe kind of overwhelmed, my online programs have lots of resources, transformative content, one-on-one coaching, group coaching, and a supportive community. If you want to learn more, just go to HeidiRogers.com. All right, friends, thank you as always for tuning in today. Our time is our most precious asset, so I truly appreciate you sharing your time with me. I'll see you right back here for the next episode of Tell the Others.